All right, so this is the 9/11, another deep state crash teleconference for the 28th of March, 2018. Ken Freeland and Cheryl Curtis are the co-facilitators, and Craig McKee is secretary. Craig, you want to call the roll?
Okay, I'll call who I have on the website here. Ken Freeland, Gordon Ferry, Cheryl Curtis. Is it Henry Bruce? Yeah, Henry Bruce.
The other way around.
The other Bruce way? Henry. I knew I'd get it wrong. Bruce Henry, sorry. I wrote it down Bruce Henry, and then I said it the other way. No idea why. Sandra Hicks, Wayne Costi, Barton Bruce, Barb Honegger, David Cole, Frank Tolopko, Lynn Bradbury, Barry Zwicker, Peter Ketchum, and me. Did I miss anyone?
This is Kathy Allard. I'm a psychologist that's just joined. So I'm going to be listening.
Okay. Oh, really after all, huh? Good for you, Kathy.
Yeah.
Is that Kathy with a C or a K?
Kathy with a K.
With a K. Okay, great. Kathy Allard. All right. Great.
All right. So with our roll call, you want to repeat the name? You already did repeat the name. Okay, so we got everybody, and we're ready to move on to approval of the minutes as circulated by Craig. Any objections to approving the minutes? We're hearing none, and the minutes are approved, and we'll move on to approving tonight's draft agenda as circulated by me. Any objections to adopting the draft agenda for tonight's use? Hearing none, then I guess we'll adopt it and proceed as soon as I can bring it back up to recollection here. Here we go. And the first item on the agenda is the deep state and the JFK assassination with our returning guest, Gordon Ferry. So, Barbara gave him a pretty good introduction last time, but Barbara, if you just want to refresh memory for just very briefly for the folks that weren't on the last call so that people know who he is.
Sure.
And we can go from there.
Yeah. Sure. Can everybody hear me okay?
Yes.
Yep.
All right. Good. Great. Okay. I'm going to not have the same kind of role I did last time because after I give Gordon's introduction, he's going to have the floor to tell us what he thinks we should know from his personal experience and from his analysis of what the military-industrial complex really is and the deep state really is. And maybe a synopsis of his recent presentation in the early part of this month at the big JFK conference outside of Washington, D.C. Okay, so my understanding is after my intro, Gordon will have about 20 minutes and then about 10 minutes for Q's and A's. Is that right, Ken?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, okay. All right. So Gordon Ferry is on the call with us, and we're really glad to have him again this month. He was our first guest and main guest last month on the February 28th call. I would like to know if everybody got the – I sent you the transcript, transcript with Gordon's corrections and additions to it in bold that I sent everybody a few days ago. Did everybody get that? And if not, you should have it from my email address. Did some of you get that already? Oh, I guess they're on mute. Well, anyway, I sent the transcript from from the audio file of last month's call with Gordon, his segment, including the Q's and A's. It was in many places, it was a very poor audio, and it took a long time to do that transcript because many people would give up with the audio. So if you would like to hear the audio, you can just read along with the transcript. And what is in bold has either been corrected by Gordon when he read through it because I couldn't hear it well, or in some cases he's added a comment, and both of those are in bold. And then yesterday, I believe, or last night, I sent everybody, I've also sent everyone Gordon's sworn jurid affidavit of the four-wheel landing gear assembly with the attached strut and landing gear door. that he saw on the Pentagon lawn, and he's now done, as he promised, a sworn jurid affidavit. And separately, I sent the sketch that was inadvertently left off. So I've sent you three emails, the transcript with the bolded, highlighted additions and corrections relative to the audio file from last month. I've sent you his sworn jurid affidavit and the that has two photos with it, and then also the sketch of what he saw from where he saw it on I-27. And we won't go into that, but if anybody has any questions about that, you can ask him about that if you've seen them in the Q's and A's. So now to just briefly, Gordon's background, and this is from his corrected transcript. Gordon has been in the Marines, the U.S. Marines. He's been a pilot. He's a trained marksman and sniper. And he has done aircraft crash recovery. He's been attached to two presidential protective details in the Secret Service as a Treasury agent, and has also been on the protective details of 8 or 9 other international heads of state when they visited the United States. He's run security for national security events for U.S. presidents and other VIPs. He's worked with the Nuclear Fuels Recovery Program. That was Admiral Rickover of the Navy's program. He's worked on methods to protect Israel's nuclear launch sites and was privy to the intelligence on the reasons for the failure of the Iranian hostage mission. Most importantly, he's been senior management for money center banks, both in the United States and Italy, financing United States international military sales. That is, sales of all major military equipment from the United States to other countries. So I think that's pretty good. He's also worked for at least a decade with Dove Zakheim, who is a very critical player in 9/11 at the Pentagon, as you know, the chief financial officer and comptroller of the Pentagon, directly under then Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld. So, Gordon, thank you so much for being with us, and go ahead.
Thank you for inviting me again, and Barbara, for all your hard work. It's a problem, as you know, for a 20-minute segment, especially when there's such a vast amount of information to what to pick. But I think it's time that a clear picture be given of what it is we're talking about that's going on. The way I'd word that is, you know, what's going on or who's in charge, not of our country, but of whether you call it the swamp or the hidden government or whatever you want to call it. I think the closest name, which is not a good one I can think of, is the global shadow government and who that is and what it is. The assassination of John Fitzgerald Kennedy was a true coup d'etat in full measure. And if you also look at the attendant assassinations of Robert Kennedy, of Justice Scalia, of Martin Luther King, of many other people, 9/11, these are not all disconnected elements that have no interactivity. That is leads you to the question of, well, who's in charge and how's it structured? The genesis of what you see occurring really took place in the 20s and 30s, that old. And on the creation concept. And that concept was created originally by David Rockefeller and John J. McCloy. David Rockefeller, who controls the Chase Bank, a New Yorker did, and is a major oil player. He is a man who has been a kingmaker behind things for a long time. The John J. McCloy in the 1930s, did a tremendous amount of work in Germany with German industrialists and Nazi industrialists. He was in the guest box with Hitler and Goering for the Olympics. And in the first part of the breakout of the war in Europe, as opposed to here, he was appointed by Henry Stimson as an assistant. And working in the U.S. government And throughout that period of time, held some interesting posts and had some interesting exposures, both under President Roosevelt and then for, of course, Harry Truman at the very end. He was Secretary of War, but for non-military events. Henry Simpson was the Secretary of War. And McCoy was hired as a consultant in September of 1940. In April 22nd of 1941, he became Assistant Secretary of War for civilian responsibilities. He was involved in some bombing decisions and targeting decisions by influencing them in favor of not hitting certain German industrial complexes. He served on government task forces during the war that created the OSS, the Office of Strategic Services, that became the CIA, the building of the Pentagon, the proposal for the United Nations, and he chaired the predecessor to the National Security Council. This is a big league player we're talking about. He also represents the Rockefeller interests overall, as well as in oil. And he worked very closely with the Chase Manhattan Bank, with the Sullivan Cromwell Law Firm. I'll come back to those. He was also very much involved in a number of other situations. He and Simpson convinced Truman to avoid stripping Germany of its industrial capacity at the end of the war. The military leaders, that three of them that went over to oversee occupied Germany, were followed by John J. McCloy, the first civilian to hold that position, where he managed to reverse a number of decisions on people like Friedrich Krupp, the arms manufacturer, clean up their backgrounds, and working with Sullivan and Cromwell in New York, arranged to have over 200 Nazi industrialists, strictly against the orders of Truman, enter the United States and be farmed out to U.S. corporations. Now, in 1975, I left Marine Midland Bank, New York, having been there 7 years. I learned at the foot of Sullivan and Cromwell international law. And when Roger Cohen, who became the highest paid lawyer in the United States, according to the front page of Time magazine, who was a brilliant man. And when I changed positions to follow the head of international there across the river to a New Jersey bank, I was given a blank check for legal support. And I discovered that Sullivan and Cromwell and Milbank Tweed, which is owned by Rockefeller, the law firm, were the only two law firms in the country who did international law. That put me in a trick because they would not take the smaller bank that I had moved to as a client. So I had to go out and practice law myself and train lawyers in order to do any work. That tells you how key Sullivan and Cromwell and Morgan Stanley and Milbank Tweed were. So in addition to bringing the Nazis in to the United States, he served as chairman of the board of that organization, and he also served in one capacity or another at the top of the Ford Foundation, the Carnegie Foundation, and the Rockefeller Foundations. In 1945 to 47, as I've commented on in earlier talks, during that period of time, the CIA, which the OAS had morphed into, occupied themselves in Asia, recovering the gold reserves and hard currency reserves of countries that Japan had overrun, and had set up offshore slush funds for operations wholly unknown to the U.S. government. That situation happened to coincide with the advent of the Marshall Plan. That put into the hands of Rockefeller and John J. McCloy the most incredible lever you can imagine. In the 1950s, they funded with funds from these sources. And later on, the CIA added to that from its drug empire and so on and so forth. They funded the United Nations. They funded the Bilderbergers creation, the Trilateral Commission, and the Foreign Policy Council in New York. The Bilderbergers were set up, as I think most people know, for those portions of their activities that are public, essentially with a North American portion and a Western European portion. And the Rothschild interests were at the peak of the European interests, and Rockefeller at the peak with McCloy on the U.S. side. But we had all the clout with these organizations, with the funding, with the CIA as a willing slave, a running dog for their activities. And at the same time, the Europeans were in a position of having to take in the largesse of the Marshall Plan and cooperate with all this. If you're familiar at all with the Bilderbergers and their general concept, and you have to understand that there are layers of knowledge within these organizations as to what's really going on. These great families, these wealthy families who have made it their business to converse privately for private deals and groups of deals and controlling the world's natural resources, the wealth, the monetary systems, the control, literally the control of the New York Federal Reserve Bank, which of all the banks is the only one that is allowed to do open market conditions and is not owned by the U.S. government. But there's ownership there of an Obergruppenführer's heirs of the SS, of the Central Bank in England, of both Alan Dulles and John Foster Dulles, and all sorts of interesting people. Basically, it's a place where people can get paid off with equity for very major contributions. So you have this structure which, over time, and with long, very long-term planning, where they plan to be flexible, they plan that something would happen, would not necessarily in their lifetimes, but something that would leave them in a position of truly controlling the world. They already control it, for all intents and purposes, the way they are right now, but they really want control. And when you have scenarios such as the assassination of Jack Kennedy, and one says, well, he'll kill them, you're not talking about James Files or the guy who pulled the trigger. That's really sort of the material. The question is who authorized it. And again, as I've covered in previous presentations, John J. McCloy was key in sitting in on two of the key meetings before the assassination. And all the rice bowls of these people were being broken by Jack Kennedy, and therefore a determination was made to kill him. He was an unwilling, in terms of Lyndon Johnson, he was an unwilling head of the coup d'etat. The CIA, as evidenced by documents that are valid, and the Zipper documents validate exactly what was going on and how difficult it was for them to keep him, who was a coward and a murderer, in his position of titular leadership. But it gave him no position at all in the power structure of the people under the Bilderbergers, and which is really just a front for the used to be the Rockefellers and the Rothschilds and the Minions and other large families. That was simply one of the turning points and the key turning points in everything that's been occurring. So if you look at each of these other situations, you will find the interconnectivity as to why people were killed, how they were killed, what game was afoot, and what have you. But don't kid yourself. The CIA and these families have been trying forever to cap off speculation on who's really at the top. And they've fought to try and keep it down to the U.S. intelligence agencies as the main ones. They've sort of given up on some of the other phony stories that they've floated. So that situation is one where, with the death of Rockefeller and John J. McCloy and the end of the Marshall Plan, with the creation of a common market in Europe and with the European alliance, a swing of the power within this group from being North America to being into Europe. So Soros, as an example, is on the Rothschild side of the equation. And there was a news breaking tonight, if you haven't heard it, that there's now evidence and connectivity between both Obama and Hillary Clinton and the Department of State and AID in funding Soros. If you haven't heard that, it's going to be very interesting. So in terms of what's going on and who did it and, you know, who's the bad guy, I guess the swamp is Congress we're talking about, or inside the bubble, what have you. But you're missing it. The real thing is what these people have been doing all along. They've already won. They already control the world. How do you go after these interests? You know, how, that's what Trump has to look at and worry about. So that is really dramatic stuff. And it is, it says that we're not dealing with bad Republicans and bad Democrats. They're all bad. Yeah, the Department of Justice, I don't mean every single person, but this is not where this stuff is coming from. The chaos is designed to be there. They want it to be there. I wish I could tell you what they had in mind with all of the Muslim situations around the world. I can't. I could never envision in my lifetime the Germans, as an example, to accept what's happened to them, or England to accept what's happened to them with the civil disruption that has occurred with unlimited immigration and so on. But trust me, they do have a plan. And that is what happened during the 50s, and that's what happened during the 60s. And I think what I'm going to do, because that's so much meat on the table, I just want to see if there's anything macro here before I go to Q&A. But we have to, and of course, as you know, the media, both in Europe and the United States, has been under the control of the people who do the dirty work, the intelligence agencies. You'll also find MI6 is involved. You'll see the Shin Bet in Israel sat in on the Zipper meetings in 1963 to coordinate something not too good. They wouldn't be at those meetings. And one other very nice piece of breaking information is Mr. Crow. You know, the actual day-to-day planning of the assassination of Kennedy, very revealing, was done, of course, under Alan Dulles. And even when he was out of office after he got fired, he was still running the show there. And the day-to-day planning was under James Angleton, who was in charge of counterintelligence and probably also a mole for the Soviets. And under him, he had two people who worked with him. One was the Crow, Russell Crowe, and the other was King. Well, I forget his name now. Point is, the Crow leaked the Zipper documents to a unknown author, and they put out a book called Regicide, which I say is accurate and real through my personal testimony I've given before. But at the same time, a new witness has come forward, and that new witness, her father had been working for decades for Naval Intelligence and for the Office of Naval Intelligence and then the CIA, and reportedly, it's in the process of being authenticated, rather not in the best way one could at this moment with the normal resources not available. But that he photographed before, during, and after the assassination. And that evidence is in possession of this individual's daughter. There is a film that is I put together where I interviewed that person. I got a fair amount of information out, which especially gives you credibility. It's a person who's known to a lot of us. And that information, for my money, will corroborate the Zipper documents and will provide the actual plan for the assassination. But much of that plan is outlined in a very forthright way in Zipper. One of the things that comes out of that is the declaration that a secret intelligence agency was formed in the 40s. And what I've done is I found that after the first two or three directors of the CIA in the 1940s, Roscoe Hillendorfer was director of the CIA in 1947. He formed the Special Projects Group, which is CIA Covert Operations. Within that projects group, he formed a special operations group for operation within the United States of America, which is wholly illegal. And lastly, a covert action division. And that there was a secret domestic operations base for it, reportedly under the National Archives. This happens to exactly parallel, in my mind, what the evidence we were looking for to corroborate the information that we have on other information we have on the existence of such a group. So that, if we can preserve that evidence, and it's a huge amount, 2 terabytes of computer information, a lot of testimony from his daughter, and a lot of other hard physical evidence, some of which I have in my possession, which I can vouch for its authenticity, most especially 2 photographs are striking to me, taken the morning of the assassination from approximately the same location in Dealey Plaza where Plumlee, the CIA pilot, was standing. And only 2 objects in the background, the Texas School Book Depository and the Dow Text Building. In addition to that, we have the daughter's testimony that he moved from there behind the through the rail yards to behind the picket fence and continued to work there. I could continue on, but I think at this point I better go to questions and answers.
Well, all right. Thank you very much for that. Before we go to Q&A, just some quick housekeeping here. We have a few new callers, and I want to find out a couple of them because they're not identified. A 650 area code, who would that be?
That's me, Kathy Aller.
Oh, that's Kathy. Okay. Thank you, Kathy. Write you in there just a second, please. Kathy Aller. Okay, and then a 845 area code.
Yeah, that's me, Sander Hicks.
That's Sander, okay. Okay, and then also, Peter Ketchum, I don't know if you were here when we did the roll call, but I just want to make sure that Mark knows you're here.
I'm here.
And Mark Miller, I don't know if we got him. But
I'm here.
Mark's also on the call.
And Marie Spike?
Marie Spike is also on the call. Uh-huh.
Chuck Smith is on the call.
Marie. Yeah, Charles Ewing Smith also on the call. Okay, Craig? You're muted, but I guess it's okay. All right. So let us proceed with Q&A. Let me turn on Q&A mode here real quick so we can do it that way. So if you want to ask a question of Gordon Ferry, you press *6, and you will be put into the queue, *6. To ask a question or make a comment. *6 on your phone. Okay, well, I guess we'll let Barbara go first. Go ahead, Barbara.
Okay, I cannot pay quite so much attention at the very moment.
Barbara, you're up. Barbara.
Oh, thank you. Okay, I didn't realize I was first. Yeah, just a clarification question, Gordon. At the very outset, when you were going over this most influential and powerful player with all of the roles that he played, was that John J. McCloy you were talking about?
Yes.
All right. Thank you. That's my question. That's it.
Sure, as a bad man.
Yeah.
Okay. And Kathy Allard, you're next.
This is Kathy Eller. I just have a quick question. Could you summarize the current status of why there's been a delay in releasing and the documents? And, you know, obviously they're going to delay, in my opinion, as long as they can. What's kind of the current situation and of that particular issue and what the current issue, you know, what the current status is of all that?
That's a, you know, a very obvious question and answer. What's happening is that the people who did all these bad things are the ones who put them in there. First, James Angleton, who did the day-to-day planning, was the man who edited any evidence that would get to the Warren Commission, aside from the fact the bulk of the people on the Warren Commission were in on it. So nothing that should have been investigated or reported ever got there. Secondly, the material that did went there, I'm sure, has been worked over tremendously because the FBI in particular, but also the CIA, were involved in the cover-up and still are to this day. And the obvious reluctance of anybody to release these documents and the stories that they gave Mr. Trump when he became president about sources and what have you that had to be protected is the highest grade of horse manure. And I keep telling people, stop waiting for this stuff to come out. I mean, you'll get something out of it. It'll take forever to cull through it. Meanwhile, there's a war going on, an absolute war worldwide over this. It's the thing is falling apart, and people are desperate because any tribunals would easily find thousands of people guilty of high treason, for which the penalty is death. So do you really expect them to come out with it and put a noose around their own necks?
Mm-hmm. So right now there's just continuing cover-up, continuing stalling of releasing any documents, and that's being controlled by the FBI right now?
Well, the people who are controlling it are the custodians. The President of the United States has made certain statements of what he agreed to do, but I know that he must be aware of it. I have tried personally to establish contact there, right to the point where I've challenged Marines at the gates, armed Marines, to try to get in to be debriefed, and I can't because I used to be there. I used to be in the business with them. Nobody will see me, but they're all very kind to me, but they're holding me at arm's length, I think, to protect me probably more than anything else.
Thank you.
I can't find out.
Mm-hmm. All right, star six if you want to ask a question or make a comment. Star six. I can't help but myself think back to a couple of books I've read that dovetail pretty closely with what Gordon's been talking about tonight. That would be Devil's Chessboard and Trading with the Enemy, both of those books. You know, kind of enfold in the same era and talk about some of the same ideas.
If I may make one quick comment.
Yeah, go ahead.
I was, for 37 years, I was the number one person in financing all international trade. It wasn't just military weapons, everything. And that doesn't mean I was bigger than anybody else. It means all the best stuff, I'm the one that always won it, never lost a deal, right? That means that I know a lot about what goes on between these family, and I know a number of the families I have personal contact with that are involved in this. I also minored in petrology, and I understand how natural resources are distributed around the world and how they've been gathered up and who did it and how the KGB, when it broke up, formed companies that went to Venezuela, as an example, in Colombia, and took the Soyuz space photography product and the stolen funds from the Soviet Union. You name it, I know about it pretty much. So I just want to say that my knowledge of that and also the financial community and the necessity to break up the money center, U.S. money center banks, all of which are corrupt, as well as the New York Fed, as well as Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac and a lot of other people.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Barton Bruce wants to ask a question. Go ahead, Barton.
Quick question. I got this book that I haven't read yet. I got it at the National Press Club the all-day event on March 2nd. But it's titled The Ghost, and its subtitle is The Secret Life of CIA Spymaster James Jesus Angleton by Jefferson Morley. If you've read it, can you comment on it, whether it's really factual and complete or incomplete or whatever?
I haven't read it. I've only read a handful of books relating to these subjects in my life. I've lived it. I haven't written, I read the books. But Angleton, my impression, and I have a lot of input that I've gotten from various sources on this. My personal feeling is, I can't prove it, is he was a Russian mole.
Thank you.
I don't know what's in the book.
And we'll let Barbara have the last word here. Quickly, Barbara, go ahead.
Well, I'm kind of surprised. I hope other people have questions. I have a clarification question, Gordon, and then a question about something that is in your transcript from last month's call. The clarification question is, when you were responding to, I think, Kathy's question about, she said, why haven't the documents come out? I just want to clarify, it's my first of two questions. Could you clarify, what documents are you referring to? Are you talking about Cheney's daughter?
No, I'm referring to the Warren Commission documents.
Okay.
Not
well,
all the subpoenaed documents that are out there that nobody's responding to.
Okay, so could you, so two separate questions then. There is the cache of government documents that were supposed to come out, as I recall, right around now. They were postponed for 6 months, as you recall, last year for a so-called national security review by Trump. So there's that. But I'm asking you if you could respond to what's happening with, I believe you'll have to spell the name, but the Cheney documents. Explain what those are and what's the status with their release.
Well, I can't be specific on that, but I can say that the reason that these subpoenaed documents never appear is we don't have an attorney general who's doing his job for reasons you can only speculate on. When it comes to Cheney, I know you know, Barbara, that I've gone on the record as saying that I feel that he is the guy, quite possibly, who has inherited Rockefeller's mantle in charge of the North American side of the equation. He's so tightly tied into the 911 incidents. He's tightly tied into the availability of the special explosives that were utilized. He's tightly closed into a lot of things, as are the neocons.
Hey, I wasn't referring to Dick Cheney. I'm referring to the woman, I believe, whose name sounds like that, Shana.
Can you
tell us about that? What are those documents?
Oh, what are the documents? My understanding of what they are, other than the few I've seen, and I've seen 42 of them, and plus two canisters. The canisters contain the actual plans for the assassination, which I believe were taken from surreptitiously from the Office of Naval Intelligence, and I believe I know how that was accomplished. Secondly, the documentation which her father had meticulously kept in notebook after notebook, every day, every activity, every place. I gave her a number of names that I wanted to ask, have her check first to see if she could find them. And, of course, the one name that I gave her was the name of the CIA director who created this special secret organization. You know, he's saying, her father said there was such an organization. Then we have this other information, you know, from another source that it's there. They didn't start two secret intelligence agencies. There's only one. It's got to be one and the same. So I want to see if that name comes up out of the database.
So my question to you is, what's the status of those documents? I understand that they have not been released, and the question is, why?
Well, because the ownership of that at the moment is in the hands of the person you know, she is told me that she is, and reaffirmed it, that she's going through and making transcripts of that 2 terabytes of information and what have you. But I have no way of knowing what the status of that is. The reason I was so desperate to get into Marine Corps intelligence is I feel that the people who are the least likely to be corrupted by what's been going on in the intelligence community, who are pros, need to put this into proper hands for not only preservation, but for analysis. And barring that, my hard recommendation was that you simply go public with it to people like the people that are in this conference. Take it to the public.
Okay, well, we're over time on this, but Charles Ewing Smith wants to ask a quick question, so we'll give him a shot, and then we'll have to move on. Go ahead, Charles.
Hi. I heard you mention James Angleton, and that brings up, in my mind, something that nobody seems to ever go further than James Angleton or Johnson or one of those guys. And I've got on my YouTube channel. Well, okay, maybe I missed it because I came in a few minutes late, but I've got it on my YouTube channel, both Muammar Gaddafi and Bassam Abu Sharif, who was a former advisor to Yasser Arafat, saying that David Ben-Gurion gave the order to kill Kennedy, and it's only logical that James Angleton would be the man who received it, because he was in bed, best friends with William Harvey and Cord Meyer, two people who are, you know, often mentioned as being part of the conspiracy. So just wondering if everybody thought that it was time to unwrap David Ben-Gurion and make him come out and people talk about him.
Now, I'll say this. Angleton is forthrightly identified as the number one day-to-day planner. And under him, in addition to the names of Harvey, Crowe, and Crowley, is Bill Sullivan from the FBI, who was the number three guy after Tolson and Hoover. The footprint in the Zipper documents for Israel is very slight, but there is a lot of other sort of anecdotal information, particularly when we talk about 911 and the missing money and the Pentagon, that suggests that they've had, I think they've moved, when the power structure moved away from North America to Europe, I think they started to hedge their bets by moving together with the Rothschilds. So that's why I said that my guess would be, it's just a guess, that Israeli intelligence and the Israeli government have gotten close to the Rothschilds.
I mean, clearly the Rothschilds, you know, paid for Israel. But
their play, by the way, is Eastern Europe.
It just strikes me odd.
Money coming from AID and the State Department that just broke today went from Obama and Hillary to Soros.
Well, anyway, but the point I'm interested in is that with both Arafat, I mean, with both Gaddafi and Abu Sharif on camera accusing, saying that bin Laden definitely gave the order, and that and I heard you say that you felt that James
Ben-Gurion, right?
I mean Ben-Gurion, yes, of course.
Yeah, okay.
Everybody always stops with the American. And there's just so much evidence with the arguments that Kennedy was having with David Ben-Gurion over Dimona and trying to keep Israel from becoming nuclear, and with Israel so determined to win no matter what, and that meant getting nuclear, plus all these other reasons Kennedy was killed. But, I mean, it was a great time to kill him because there was a lot of people that wanted to kill him. But that's, for me, it's, all roads lead to Ben-Gurion. And in the last 4 or 5 years, since I've known about this, well, since 2013, I haven't seen anybody mention it but me.
All right, let me comment on that. Let's start with the Zipper documents. The Zipper documents specifically named Amos Manor, M-A-N-O-R, who is in charge of the Shin Bet. It was the last year he was in that position in Israel, present at these one or two of these organizational meetings. And, you know, it's not clear from the Zipper documents, other than coordinating, who he represented. But on the other hand, in talking to Barbara and talking about Dov Zakheim and his relationship with Ariel Sharon, as an example, there's some interconnectivity of that. I have knowledge of the, some knowledge of the activities with the Liberty and what happened there. And
well, but Angleton was involved with the formation of the Mossad. I mean, before the CIA was even formed, he was involved with developing the Mossad. So, I mean, he was a mole. He was an Israeli mole from day one in the CIA. Why don't we jump on that situation? I mean, I just wonder why nobody talks about that.
You're probably not aware of this, but I've worked closely on occasion with Israeli military intelligence and with the Mossad. In fact, the Mossad saved my life once. And I'm telling you that I do not I put it past anybody in Israel to have been involved in this, because you're quite right. They are completely focused on survival for themselves. Who wouldn't be, you know? And there's been some things there that I've not minced my words with, talking directly to them, that I wasn't happy with, and of course the Liberty was one of them. Yeah.
Oh, horrifying!
So
anyway,
you could go on
with this, but we really are out of time with it. But thanks for that question, through Charles, and maybe you could communicate privately with Gordon regarding this if you wish. But we need to move on. Okay, thank you again, Gordon, for taking time and sharing your. Your very authoritative look at the deep state and the attendant matters, because it's definitely right up our alley. We appreciate it very much, okay?
Know your enemy.
That's right. That's right. Okay.
Well, thank you for the opportunity.
You're most welcome. Welcome back anytime, okay?
Okay. Thank you.
Okay, so now we need to move on to our next item on the agenda, and that would be, I can scroll down here, that would be, scroll down too far, I'm sorry, one moment please. That would be Mark Miller and Bruce Henry, our Massachusetts Trekkers. Are they here? Am I here? Can anybody hear me?
I think everybody's muted, Ken. I think that's the
problem. Everybody's muted. Yeah, okay, thank you, Craig. Let me take us off of Q&A mode here for a second. Okay, so it looks like our guests did not make it.
Hello? Hello?
Hello?
Hello?
Yep.
Whom are you saying hello to?
This is Mark Miller.
Oh, Mark. Okay, yeah, there's Mark. Okay, so I guess we do have our guests here. Okay, one moment.
Bruce is here, too.
And Bruce is here, too. Okay, very good. All right, sorry about the meeting there. That was oversight. So, let's see. Cheryl, were you going to introduce him or what?
No, Frank is going to introduce him.
Frank is going to. Okay. Frank, go ahead.
Okay. Yeah, hi. Frank here. As some of you know, I live in Massachusetts in the western part of the state. They refer to us as the Golden West back in the Boston area. And I've been doing 9/11 things and deep state things and research, and didn't realize that there were two guys up in Pittsfield, about 25 miles north of me, doing the same thing. I got a phone call from them about back in the fall, and we had stayed in touch, and I saw a newspaper article that they're going to be walking across Massachusetts from Provincetown, which is all the way to the tip of Cape Cod, all the way to New York line, probably about 150 or 160 miles in terms of distance, and trying to get people to listen to some things about 9/11 too. So Bruce is a retired math teacher in the State College here in Massachusetts, and he's also an engineering analyst at GE Ordnance in Pittsfield when he was working. He's now retired. Mark Miller is a former editor and co-owner of the Berkshire Eagle, which is a local newspaper here in Great Barrington area, which tends to be on the liberal side, but not necessarily on the issue of 9/11, but taking pretty good stances. So I've been in touch with them, and I mentioned that they should come on the show here and tell what they're going to do. Perhaps there are people on the call that are in Boston area. They're probably going to be passing through, perhaps the Worcester area and other points west from there. So I don't want to take away from their time because I have limited time to talk what they're going to do. So I'll turn it over to them.
Hello.
You want to talk? It was your idea, Mark. You were on.
Well,
do you want to lead off?
Okay. Yeah. Well, it's just it's a marketing device to try to shine some light on this subject, 9/11 and all of the lies and to try to reach ordinary people to try to get speaking engagements here and there, much easier said than done, whether in churches or on college campuses, and to visit newspapers and see if we can get an interview, whether weekly or daily newspapers. Just engage with anyone we might find along the route, and just chat with them, answer their questions, get back to them with any questions that we don't have answers to, and because it's just not as mysterious as people. A lot of people just have no idea, and to try to and get some publicity, to have a website, to have which we really haven't, even though we've got less than 2 weeks to go, we haven't set up a website yet, Facebook page. We want to ideally, we'd really get enough attention in the 9/11 truth community so that at some point someone would pick up on the eastern side of New York State and go all the way to the west. Not someone, but maybe a group, and just continue it all the way out to California. You know, part of the inspiration for this actually was Granny D out in California. She's a New Hampshire woman who in her 80s who walked across the United States for campaign finance reform, I think it was, and that, you know,
mm-hmm.
I don't think she really made any difference, but at least you know, she tried, and that's what we're doing.
Yeah, we originally had some signs made up, but we decided that would be too cumbersome to carry in a sandwich board. We're stepping back from that. We're hoping to have to be able to present talk at the Provincetown Library. There's a kindly woman who's helping us out with that. But we haven't really gotten any other speaking engagement lined up. Also, I'm a Unitarian. Mark's an Episcopalian. And not all Unitarians are 9/11 truthers. I was thinking to get Sanctuary along the way, Unitarian churches. So we're not too far along in that project, I'm sorry to say.
Yeah, and I've had a number of kind of family obligations that have kept me away from working on this as diligently and as much as I'd like to be doing. But we're hoping that one thing leads to another, and that through word of mouth in the movement, things will emerge. Opportunities will emerge. One of the things any questions? Why don't we go into questions?
Yeah. Okay. Let's go into Q&A mode. I'm sure somebody somewhere has a comment or a question to ask of these interesting fellows. So let's do Q&A mode. Unmute Bruce and unmute. Oops, the other guy. Unmute Mark. Oh, he's already unmuted. Okay. So, if there are any questions or comments, star six if you want to ask a question or make a comment. And Lynn Bradbury, you're first.
Hi, this is Lynn Bradbury. I commend you for putting your energy to this task. I really think you need some sort of sign, lightweight, maybe out of sheets, to attract attention. You can't count how many people might.
We do have to have some kind of signs. I've thought about cutting up kind of stiffish, reusable grocery bags and use the insides of those, and we could pin them to a backpack and the front of our torsos.
Do you have an accompanying vehicle?
No, we don't have any chase vehicle. But we've, volunteers of my wife is going to help out. It'll get easier as we move west. And we're going to follow the main surface road all the way through Cape Cod and then on to 3A, which is near the coast. Winds up in Quincy and then Boston, and I don't know exactly what we'll do in Boston, but we have several things in mind, and then we'll proceed west to through Worcester, and then mostly follow Massachusetts Route 9, goes all the way to Pittsfield, and we have some places to stay along the way there, and
Good. That was that old lady was Granny D, and also I think Pam Zenzi, if that's her name, might have biked across. She might have some pointers for you. Maybe calling ahead so people know you're coming.
Yeah.
Those Unitarian churches. But if you're just walking and there's no indication of what you're doing, then you're robbing yourselves of interaction with people.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, good luck.
Thanks.
Okay. And Barbara Reiniger. Barbara.
Hi. This is a great project, and I guess some minds think in the same way. I was going to mention that you really do need to, before you start, while you're still planning and organizing, you need to contact Pamela Senzi. That's S-E-N-Z-E-E. And I can give you her email address here in a moment if you'd like, or at the end of the call during the announcement period, because I have to go get it. But Pamela Senzi, not only with another woman, on behalf of Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth, they biked completely across the United States. But Pamela Senzi and Dave Meiswinkel, who is an attorney in New Jersey, former New Jersey policeman, former U.S. Marine for a short period of time. He and Pamela literally walked from Ground Zero at New York City. Well, I can't remember where they started, but they went to all three main sites, Pennsylvania, Ground Zero in New York City and the Pentagon, and they mm-hmm. walked the entire way. So uh-huh. they have lots of experience. They have lots of pointers, and you need to get in touch with both of them.
Okay. Well, if you could give us the e-addresses, I would certainly appreciate that.
Yeah, what I will do, if it's all right, unless you already have them, Ken, I can send them to you or Cheryl, and you could forward to these two guys.
Yeah, Barbara, if you could send them to me, I can pass them on to these guys.
Is that Cheryl? Is that Cheryl?
Yes. Yeah, that's me, Cheryl, yeah.
Okay, good. I will.
Okay.
Yeah. And I think that was it for our Q&A. So thank you, gentlemen, for bringing your wonderful voyage to our attention. And we wish you well and hope we can keep us in the loop maybe along the way. If it takes place over the last Wednesday, you'd like to call in and give us a report and let us know how it's going. Okay?
Okay. Yeah. We'll do.
You're good. All right. Good luck to you both. And that brings us to our congressional candidate, Sandra Hicks. And I think Sandra's pretty well known to everybody on the call. I don't think anybody was prepared to do a particular introduction here. But I think Sandra is well known enough that he probably needs
I think Wayne was going to introduce him.
Wayne? Oh, I beg your pardon. Okay, Wayne, if you're going to introduce him, let me... and you can do the honors.
Yep. Can you hear me now?
Uh huh.
So I'd like to introduce you to Sam Hicks. This is his bio. You may know who he is, but it's a pretty impressive resume. So Sanders is a lifelong peace activist and social entrepreneur, a visionary writer, independent publisher, and award-winning social change businessman. Sanders has spoken widely across the United States on 5 national tours, ranging from radical bookstores to Stanford Law School. Hicks is a veteran of several electoral and campaigns with various progressive and reform movements. He was elected president of the Cortelyou Road Merchants Association in 2003. Since 2013, Sanders has run a profitable woodworking business and Space Masters, Inc. Sander and his team run a creative website called loftbedsnyc.com, which provides space-making solutions to working people in New York City. In 2016, Zen Carpentry won 2 awards from the City of New York for the Best of New York program, Best for Workers, Best for the Environment, in Queens. Sander appeared in the national media from 1999 to 2001, for republishing the controversial George W. Bush biography, Fortunate Son. His struggle to print the full story about then-Governor Bush was covered by 60 Minutes, New York Times, Washington Post, and the award-winning documentary Horns and Halos, broadcast on HBO Cinemax in 2003. Hicks's response to the war on terror was to create a positive alternative in the form of a community coffee house, Vox Pop, Inc., 100% fair trade. Vox Pop became an award-winning coffee house which used live events and community empowerment and educational programs to improve a struggling neighborhood in Flatbush, Brooklyn. As a writer, he's written several plays and is an alumnus of the esteemed New Dramatist Development House. He has personally confronted Dick Cheney, Rudy Giuliani, Richard Benveniste, Jerome Hauer, and several other government officials about the 9/11 cover-up. His work of investigative journalism from 2005 was entitled The Big Wedding, and today has 14,000 copies in print. Today he serves as the New York City facilitator of the 9/11 Truth Action Project, a 9/11 nonprofit working for justice for the 9/11 families. His most recent book is Slingshot to the Juggernaut, Total Resistance to the Death Machine, means Complete Love of the Truth, from Soft Skull 2012. The book offers a vision of nonviolence and calls us to deeper respect for the truth and for the proud future of the USA, if we get the truth. Raised Catholic, he's a Quaker attendee, Rinzai Zen practitioner, interfaith activist who seeks conflict resolution by understanding The Call to Justice in All Humanity is Religions. His work is recognized at the end of 2016 with a special commendation from the State Senate of Louisiana. He's also the proud father of his son, Coleman Elias Anderson Hicks. And with that, I'll turn the microphone over to Sander. So welcome.
Thank you, guys. Thanks for having me on your call. So many people on this call I respect. I'm sorry that my bio is so long. I forgot that I told Wayne to read the one off the campaign website. So that was longer than it had to be. But I know it's you guys have been on this call now for like an hour and 10 minutes. And so anyway, thanks for having me on. So I'm running for United States Congress. I'm challenging Carolyn Maloney in the Democratic primary. This is the first time running as a Democrat, but I'm inspired by Bernie Sanders, and I'm inspired by the vision of justice. I'm inspired by 16 years of activism, 9/11 truth, and I'm inspired by the fact that by advocating for the release of the 28 pages, we got the 28 pages released, and then just passed in Congress, which was a, you know, a small step forward for the movement. So I think the Democrats are an extremely corrupt political party, and so nobody has to try to convince me of that, but I think it's a great opportunity to run inside the primary. So what I'm doing here is I'm running up against this woman, Carolyn Maloney. She has been in power for 26 years. She's extremely wealthy. She's very vulnerable in a number of ways. There's very low voter turnout in the primaries. The last time she was elected, only 15,000 people voted for her in the Democratic primary, which is only about 2% of the population that she represents. So, you know, amongst the many, serious political issues in this country, such as the lack of electoral involvement, the lack of you know, compared to other industrialized nations, the amount of voters that we have registered that are eligible to register is very low, and the amount of people that vote compared to who are registered is very low. And that's because the political choices are so paltry. You know, we saw that in the last presidential election, of course. So I feel that Carolyn Maloney is vulnerable and should be vulnerable. She voted for the Iraq War. She is a strong, strong proponent of Zionist Israel. She actually wants them to support BDS. You know, there's such a very strong anti-BDS movement in this country, boycott, divest, sanction, that people are floating legislation now that is a violation of civil liberties. You know, the ACLU itself says you can't outlaw protesting against Israel. You can't outlaw advocating for BDS, but that's not the kind of thing that here. She's actually co-sponsored HR 1897. So a big shout out to my friend Janet Zampieri, all on the board of Truth Action Project. She also volunteers and speaks to me weekly on our countrywide, nationwide volunteers conference call. And if anybody wants to get involved with that, please contact me. But Janet found some really great opposition research on Carolyn Maloney. So Maloney, in terms of 9/11, you know, she presided over this giant 9/11 cover-up in New York City. She did at first advocate for a new investigation, and so she did show some courage. However, that courage evaporated after the 9/11 Commission did release its report. So there was no follow-through there. Obviously, it was politically too hot for her to follow through. But what I've done is I've always been an independent person. I've been an independent publisher. And author. I've written as a journalist for Huffington Post and Alternet and a whole bunch of other independent sites and sources and print publications. So I did two books about the 9/11 cover-up based on independent, original research, not just copying stuff off the internet or paraphrasing others' research, but doing confrontations with people like Richard Benvenise, who was a member of the 9/11 Commission, and Jerome Hauer, who was a deep state actor who's kind of like L. Paul Bremer. He's one of the people that was advancing the official story on 9/11. You know, Jerome Howard was the guy who spoke to Dan Rather. I confronted him in a telephone call on Labor Day about 10 years ago, and it was quite informative, and I recorded it actually on standard.com to this day. So I feel compelled to run this race. sorry. Everyone okay? I feel compelled to run this race because it seems like it's a good time to use the campaign as a way to advocate for a new investigation of 9/11. In the wake of the founding of Truth Action Project and the Lawyers Committee for 9/11 Inquiry, in the wake of all this new national activism, I think we could actually get something done here. And so that was my original impetus for running. Now I'm actually kind of expanded it, and I'm thinking, like, well, it's possible that I could run to win if I emphasize all the positive stuff, all the positive foundational ideas behind doing something like this. And what are those positive foundational ideas? Well, I truly believe that every human being loves peace and loves truth and loves light, and that the deep state exposure movement is not the only, you know, exclusive source of truth, and that we actually, I think there's a universal need for peace and disarmament, truth and transparency. And so I am creating the possibility that I can connect to people and that I can inspire them and move them by hitting them over the head with Golden 7 right away, but by saying, hey, the reason I've done all of this activism against the war on terror and against the Bush-Cheney cover-ups is because I'm fundamentally a peace activist. I actually really believe that the future of the United States of America is to become a more nurturing, compassionate country that doesn't demonize any world religion, it doesn't demonize any minority or people or country, and actually it becomes a leader in conflict resolution, peaceful mutual agreement, compromise, diplomacy. Some of the things I've been writing about that are very positive on HicksForCongress.com is a policy paper about opening up new diplomacy to Iraq and how and why it can be done, what would need to happen. And I even said it would be good for Israel. You know, I kind of put it in the context of, you know, trying to run a campaign that appeals to a lot of people and not, you know, doesn't demonize any one people. So, but I am very concerned about where our country is going under Trump. I'm very concerned with the appointment of John Bolton, deep state actor, all the way back from Iran-Contra. This guy was involved in narcotics. He covered up the narcotics tensions at Iran-Contra on behalf of Ed Meese, then Attorney General. And this guy is very dirty on his issue. Also go to war with Iran, fully supports the war in Iraq to this day. John Bolton is somebody that we should all be very concerned about, and it helps to expose the falsity of Trump's promises to drain the swamp, because John Bolton is a swamp creature, and for him to be appointed, it's almost as bad as Ms. Haskell there being Haskell being appointed CIA director, the torture expert from overseas. So yeah, I've got other positive ideas about public interest venture capital and saving the environment and protecting workers, protecting students, bailing out student loan debt, you know, a bailout for Main Street, not just a bailout for Wall Street. But since we're on a deep state call, I'll say this, that I think this is a historical first. This is the first time that anyone in New York City has stood up and attempted to run for high political office, federal political office, as a out-and-out truther, truth lover, truth advocate. You know, I've been that for a long time. My background goes back to 1999 when I was the publisher of a biography of Bush, A Fortunate Son. I told the truth about Bush, told the truth about the Bin Laden-Bush business connection way back in 1999. It's funny I mention this now because I'm actually outside on Delaney and Ethics, literally only a couple blocks away from where my old headquarters used to be when I was a publisher taking on the Bush family in my little basement office down there on Suffolk and Delancey. So if anybody knows New York City, we're down here on Delancey, crossing Delancey, right near the Williamsburg Bridge. And so I'm kind of going back in time now. I'm going back 19 years to when Jim Hatfield, the author, who's now dead, walked me around the corner and he said, I'm going to tell you a secret. My secret sources on the Bush cocaine arrest were Carl Rove and Clay Johnson, and you can't ever tell anybody that. But then he ended up dying right after he himself went public with that information, and leaving us, his survivors, to wonder, was it really a suicide? Was it a CIA assassination? I've gone back and forth on that issue, but suffice to say, I'm excited to do this. I think it's the kind of thing that I've lived all my life to do, and I'm more than willing to take your questions. I'll say this, though, before I get off, is that very grateful to Jane Clark, a lawyer, friend, member of the Lawyers Committee for 9/11 Inquiry, because this recent trip I did in February, speaking in 20 cities in 30 days, was very eye-opening. I spent a lot of time doing research, researching things like the Shea Memo, which further exposed the Mossad connection to 9/11. The Shea Memo is something I wanted to urge everybody to look to, S-H-E-A Memo, if you haven't already. I was surprised that I had never read about it before. It is a memo drafted as almost like an indictment from an attorney who was trying to file a kind of friendly, friend-of-the-court-style brief to Congress. And so he wanted the joint inquiry into 9/11 to look at the Israeli-Mossad connection. And this is a story that we should all look into, because the Shea Memo is worth reading. It's well-indexed and well-researched, and it has copious footnotes and appendices. It even somehow produces the entirety of a DEA memo from June of 2001, in which the DEA is saying it almost has its hands in the air, pleading for help, asking other intelligence agencies to help it understand why Israel has been penetrating the DEA, trying to sell art into DEA homes and offices of agents. They were showing up at agents' homes, and they said clearly these are not these Israelis are overqualified to be art students. They're actually they have military backgrounds that make us think that this is some sort of intelligence operation. And so Shea, this attorney, later went on to point out that the same Israeli art students clearly were an intelligence operation. They were actually very, very close to the 9/11 hijackers, or the 9/11 so-called hijackers, the 9/11 patsies. And so that was a great eye-opening experience. Even now in 2018, there's this new information. You know, I had never seen this memo. This memo was written in 2004. So I'm really grateful for the heightened political activism and the heightened consciousness that this campaign and these calls and my activism with Truth Action Project in New York City, where I just was right before this call, it's making me be a better activist and a better a truth seeker. Thank you. I'll take any questions you have.
Oh, I think it's going to Q&A mode.
Oh, it's over? Well, that's it, folks. Q&A session is over. You missed it.
Try again. All right, so it's six, if you'd like to ask. All right, so we'll start out with Lynn Bradbury.
Hi, this is Lynn Bradbury. I'm looking for the Shea Memo, but it might help if you could give us a link. Thank you. Bye.
Oh, sure. Yeah, thank you for asking. S-H-E-A Memo. It'll come up. Counterpunch did a story on it. So if you Google Counterpunch, S-H-E-A Memo, Shea Memo, it will come up. You just have to look around. Salon.com at one point had an 11,000-word article on the Shea Memo and its cover-up and suppression ready to go. And at the last minute, Salon.com had their story killed because somebody said, "Oh, this is not really a story." Yeah, we've heard the story before. It reminds me of the time the 28 pages came out, people, and both the Washington Post and NPR said, "Oh, well, the 28 pages are out now, but really, there's nothing here." As the esteemed Barbara Honegger will point out to you, and has pointed out in public many a time, Prince Vandar is mentioned 18 times in the 28 pages. So when the media says there's nothing here, that usually means there's something there.
All right. Well, speaking of Barbara Honegger, let's give her a chance to begin. Go ahead, Barbara.
Oh, hi. Yeah, it's Barb. I was going to ask the same question Lynn did. So if we understand, we go to Google Counterpunch and Shea, S-H-E-A memo, and we should get the actual memo with all the references. Is that right?
That's right. Or you can email me tomorrow, Barbara, and I'll forward you my email from Jane. I pulled over in Jackson Hole, Wyoming, and I spent the day in the library reading the entire thing, and my mind was really blown. It's a really great document, and I can't believe that this thing was written and given to Congress in 2004, and here it is 14 years later, and I think of us as some of the cutting-edge 9/11 truth researchers in this country, and I can't believe we haven't seen it before. But,
well, who is Shea?
Gerald Shea was an international, or is an international, corporate attorney, and I've been trying to track him down. And I actually just Googled Shea memo, and it's the second thing that comes up on my phone. It's on Scribd.com. Gerald Shea memo to the 9/11 Commission. It's on Scribd.com. I can't give you a lot of information about Gerald Shea, because I don't know a lot of information about him. All I know is that he knows how to write a damn good memo that's well-sourced, well-presented, and is clearly a good lawyer. So here, I found it for you people. It's on Scribd.com, S-C-R-I-B-D.com. It's on multiple websites. If you go into this, I would start with maybe page 40 or 50. Look at the general summary to give like a 5-page summary. Don't be intimidated because it's 160 pages, because most of that is the appendices, like the DEA memo from June 2001. You can just skim. And if I could tie it back into the campaign, this is like, I think, the best way to fight the DNC corruption that is controlled by Wall Street, controlled by the military-industrial complex, controlled by the deep state, the pseudo-progressives. And, you know, I've already been called anti-Semitic. I've already been called all kinds of things just for saying, you know, the occupied territories are, you know, not Israel to occupy, and that we need to investigate the CIA and Israel's connection to 9/11. I actually said that in the media in a local paper recently, and called Town and Village. So I've been getting into this, and you know, I would love an opportunity in mainstream media, in the New York Times, to like point out the existence of the Shea memo, and I fully intend to, which is why it would be great to get a contribution from each and every one of you tomorrow at HicksForCongress.com. After that Town and Village media exposure, Facebook stopped allowing us to link to our website. I'm going to repeat that. After the anti-Israel, critical of Israel, critical of Zionism, critical of CIA 9/11 cover-up media coverage, I got in Town and Village newspaper. Now we can no longer post a link to HicksForCongress.com. So there's something that's really rotten here. You know, it could be just a coincidence. Maybe it's just a coincidence that the day after or a couple days after we get this media coverage, and then I start – actually, you know what it was? It was the day after I posted about the media coverage on Facebook. I said, wow, I can't believe they allowed me to print this, or I can't believe they printed my comment verbatim. But it was a pretty good story because they just kind of let me go, and they didn't slant it, and they didn't say, oh, he's crazy. He's an anti-Semite. He's you know, insane. They simply let me say what I wanted to say, and And now, for some reason, Facebook will not let you post. You couldn't even post it. You could, you know, go ahead and try. Try to post a link to hicksforcongress.com. So we're obviously fighting a pretty important battle here at Ground Zero in New York City. We need your support. We need your help. If you wanted to help us, you know, you can volunteer on weekly conference calls. We have a nationwide network. And if you'd like to make a contribution, your contribution is more than welcome at hicksforcongress.com.
Okay, Hicks.
Okay, Sander, I think I'm still on. Am I still on?
Yeah, Barbara, we're out of time, and there's two more people that want to ask questions. Okay?
Well, that's fine, but I haven't been able to make my comment, and it'll be short.
Okay.
If you can ever get to this Gordon Shea, ask him to be on this call. That's number one. Number two, I've been working back and forth with Kevin Barrett, and we both believe, and he's put it out and I've put it out, and we're working on a special project. The best answer to a claim of anti-Semitism is to simply point out the fact that Palestinians are Semites, and that Israel, the way they treat the Palestinians, they are the most anti-Semitic state on the planet.
Got it. Yep. I got it.
Okay.
All right. Well, good luck.
Thank you, Barbara.
Thank you, Barbara.
And then we've got Wayne Costi. Make it quick, Wayne, so we can get to Barry, too, please. Thank you.
Thanks, Sandra. I'm just curious about the amount of on-the-ground support that you're getting down in New York, and what we can do to help. So that's kind of the main kind of question. So
great. Well, here's what you can do. Tomorrow from 6:30 p.m. to 7:30 p.m., I'll be speaking and doing a kind of a debate-style event with Representative Maloney and the other contender, Suraj Patel. This is an event that's happening at the Seafarers International Hall on 15th Street in Irving. That's East 15th, right near Union Square. It's a possible endorsement that we may get from the Bernie-crat people. So Bernie Sanders' organization in New York City has organized this. So we have not been getting a lot of love from the local
government. I wonder if you can hear me there, Sanders. Sander, can you hear me? It's Barry Zwicker in Toronto.
Yeah. Sorry, Barry. I was just in the middle of finishing an answer there.
Sorry. The voice came on and said I should go ahead. You go ahead.
Oh, okay. Sorry. You know what? That's fine, Barry. You can go ahead and jump in because I know we got to wrap it up here. But I was just going to go off and say that the normal Democratic Party groups have not really been very supportive, of course. But we're very hopeful for the Bernie Sanders group tomorrow. And if you want to come, Wayne, come from Jersey, that would be great. Please do.
Great. Yeah, and the first thing I want to add is that good luck to you tomorrow there, Sander. This is great what you're doing, as always. Actually, I'm speaking because the audio has been very, very poor, at least from my end, on this teleconference. Along the way, you did mention someone who is deceased, and the question would be whether it was suicide or murder. And I just didn't catch who that was. However, whomever it was, I wonder if you have any comment on the upcoming third anniversary of the death of Michael Rupert around April 13th, I think it was 3 years ago, that he left us. And do you happen to have any thoughts or knowledge about the departed Michael Rupert?
Oh, yeah. Well, it's funny, you know, I'm down here on Delancey Street right now. I remember being with him here. We actually had lunch once at a diner right over here. In fact, it's literally across the street where I'm on Esther and Delancey, and I remember there used to be a little Greek diner here. It's a big skyscraper that's going up right now. It's literally, it looks like Building 7, actually. It's like, there used to be a tiny little Greek diner, and he Mike Rupert slept on my floor in the office over there on Suffolk Delancey, and I remember crying 3 years ago. I was in a cab
going to my therapist, and I heard that he died. And but you know what? I'll say this: he's still really remembered, and he's still really well loved. I invoked his name quite a bit on this speaking tour in February, and always felt like I was getting a good feeling in the room or a good response, or you know, his name. His name is well respected, and his name is powerful, and it keeps on coming up every time. You know, he's living on in a lot of YouTube videos, a lot of research. You know, especially looking at Promise or Inslaw or Marshall McLennan or AIG or the drug money laundering that AIG. Has been accused of, and looking at that angle of 9/11, the whole parole security, Marshall McLennan, AIG angle, which is you know, kind of a slightly different angle than the Mossad angle, but related, but not completely on the same page, you know. So I'll tell you this: there's actually a very esoteric book called Jesus the Magician that is. Talks about the power of the dead. This is not your average New Testament study, but it kind of talks about the power of some of the magic of one of the things that Jesus was said to have learned was that if somebody is assassinated or somebody is killed or they die unjustly, like so many people that we know have, including Jim Hatfield, the late great Bush biographer who I was friends with, back in the day. What Jesus the Magician says is that there's a way to kind of like step into their energy and become that. And so out of their death, you get new life. So Jesus did that when John the Baptist was assassinated. You know, his beloved folk hero, his mentor, his cousin, John the Baptist, you know, this revolutionary, Essene, traveling prophet, right? So Jesus was able to kind of like fuse his identity with John the Baptist. So people, you know, like death and life are a cycle, and Mike Rupert is not really totally gone. You know, we're still carrying on his work, and I can say right now, I am Mike Rupert. You know, I am Jim Hatfield. I'm doing the work that they would be doing now, you know, advocating for new investigations of the fat cats and, you know, pointing the finger at the drug money and the, you know, the crony capitalism and the corruption. You know, I can't wait tomorrow for the debate with Maloney. I'm going to mention Seth Rich.
Yep.
To say, like, you know, it's okay. We should have Democrats that are gutsy, courageous, and are not afraid to mention the word Seth Rich.
Yeah. Unfortunately, we're out of time, but Sandra, 9/11 Truth candidates are always welcome on our teleconference, so we hope to have you back to discuss the progress of your campaign and your future, okay?
Great. Thanks a lot for your support.
That's
okay.
Inspiring, Sandra.
Thank you.
All right. Now we're going to take a moment for announcements, and then we'll move on to talk about coming teleconferences and who we might look toward inviting. So let's end the Q&A here real quick. And does anyone have any announcements they'd like to hear with us?
This is Wayne.
Wayne, go ahead.
Yeah, so this is a repeat of what I said last month. On April 15th, the NoForeignBases.org group is launching their Spring Action 2018. There's going to be a march and rally at various places around the country. If you go to the 911tap.org website, there's an article about this, and you can go to the events calendar for April 15th, and you'll see the different cities. It's San Francisco, the Bay Area, Minneapolis, Atlanta, New York, Chicago, places in Maine. There's a whole bunch of them. And other places that I can't recall off the top of my head. So we're hoping I'm hoping the 9/11 truth message will get out there. You can go to their Spring Action, the website Spring Action 2018.org, I guess, and you can endorse it. And if you do, use a 9/11 truth affiliation to identify yourself. That's all.
Okay. See on the Thank screen. You. Thank you, Wayne. So who else has an announcement?
What's it about? Did you
No. Okay, well, I guess that's it then, for the announcements, and we'll move on to talk about coming teleconferences. Barbara, you had a good idea, I think, when you were talking with somebody earlier. What was that one? Barbara, are you still here? Yes?
I think she's muted. Just a second. I'll unmute her.
Yeah, she is muted.
Yeah,
okay.
Can you hear me?
Can you hear me now, Barbara? Go ahead. Yeah.
Yeah, well, I have a major announcement, remember, about the grand jury petition filing.
Yes. Let's hear that one. And we'll
yeah,
about
this is literally a major item for the call. All right. So from last month's call, you know from the announcements that the Lawyers Committee for 9/11 Inquiry, ever since two anniversaries ago, the big Justice Focus event in New York City, that we have been working on the grand jury petition on World Trade Centers 1, 2, and 7. This is an incredible legal document that lays out in the most professional way all of the critical and most compelling evidence that the official story, not only that the official story cannot be true at World Trade Centers 1, 2, and 7, but what happened at World Trade Centers 1, 2, and 7. Now, I have been an honor to be on the Lawyers Committee Grand Jury Petition Research and Drafting Committee. It's a very small committee, about five or six of us. And we were hoping that it would be delivered to the U.S. Attorney for the Southern District of New York Federal Court yesterday, and that was the expectation last month, and I mentioned that. Problem was is that I can't tell you why there was a delay, but it was for a very good reason. Something was attempted that didn't work out, but now we do have something that worked out. So here's the bottom line. The current plan, now of course it could change, but I'm going to tell you how you will know what day it's actually being delivered. The current plan is for the grand jury petition on World Trade Centers 1, 2, and 7 of the Lawyers Committee, a work of 2 years, a magnificent document, 50 or more pages, 50 plus pages, and voluminous attached exhibit from all the references. The plan is to deliver it on Tuesday, April 10th, late morning, to the courthouse in New York City, the federal courthouse. However, that could change. The way you will know if that's going to happen on Tuesday the 10th is all you need to do is to go to opednews.com. It's a very high-end juried alternative news website and analysis website. Oped, O-P-E-D, news, N-E-W-S.com. It could be org, but I think it's com. The plan is we have an exclusive with opednews.com to publish an article about the delivery the next day, assuming it does happen the next day on the 10th. So you will know if it's going to happen on the 10th if the article on the delivery and the grand jury petition appears in Op-Ed News on the 9th. And this is what everybody is being asked to do. Do not mention it before that. The reason is it shouldn't even go out on the draft minutes of this call prior to the 9th. And the reason is it has been very difficult to get an agreement for Op-Ed News to give us an exclusive in exchange for having the exclusive. The agreement is that no one else will put it out before the 9th. Assuming it happens on the 10th. So all you have to do is not say anything between now and the 9th of April, and on the morning, I would say late morning for sure, of the 9th, Monday the 9th of April, go to Op-Ed News, and if the article is there, it will refer you to the Lawyers Committee for 9/11 Inquiry website, where if it's going to be delivered on Tuesday the 10th, it will already be, the actual petition and the exhibits will actually be on the Lawyers Committee website by late morning on the 9th. So you'll be able to read it on the 9th and let everybody in the world on all of your lists everywhere know to go to, give them the link to the op-ed news article and give them the link to the Lawyers Committee website to read the petition.
All right. Well, hopefully on the next call, Barbara will have a bit more to tell us about the petition because it will be front page news by that time, we hope.
Yeah, let us hope. And just so everybody knows, it's very exciting. I've been asked on the behalf of the Lawyers Committee and the coordinator for Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth and TAP, the Truth Action Project throughout Europe and the UK. Richard Gage and I will be doing a speaking tour together from May 9th to 16th in Utrecht, Holland, in the Netherlands, in Brussels, Belgium, and in London, England. So we are going to be talking at length about the content of the grand jury petition and the legal process involved.
Barb, is anybody going to videotape the lawyers submitting papers? I mean, I think that would be documented somehow, don't you think?
I'm not sure what your question is. If your question is the actual act of Nick Harrison, who is the Lawyers Committee Executive Director and Director of Litigation, and Dave Meitrinkel, is it going to be taped with them going up the steps to take it in and hopefully also tape it going in and handing it to the U.S. Attorney's Office? Yes.
Oh, good, yeah, because this is Chuck Smith. And on the TAP calls, you know, I had recommended that we document this any way we can.
Yes, yes, and the person who's going to be, who's arranging the videotaping is Les Jamieson.
Oh, terrific. Great.
Yeah. So that should be available, and hopefully as soon as Les can get it up, I'm sure he'll let us all know.
Also needs to be in the archives for a larger documentary of some kind.
Yeah, I'm not sure what you mean by the archives, but it will be available.
Well, there will be an archive. That will be entry number one.
What archive?
Hey, you know, I made the documentary for TAP. I mean, for the lawyers, you know, we talked about it. There's an opportunity in the future if we document things.
Oh, you mean to do another documentary? Sure. Yeah.
Well, yeah, about this particular aspect of it, of the lawyers, and where it goes from there. So that's all I'm suggesting is I'm glad Les is on top of it. That's all. Thank you.
Yeah. Well, I asked him to do it, and he agreed. So Bob McElvain is planning to be with Dave Meiswinkle, who's, of course, an attorney, New Jersey attorney, who's a member of the Lawyers Committee. Julio Gomez and Bob McElvain and Dave Meiswinkle and Harrison will be delivering it, and Les Jamieson will be taping their delivery of it. We hope, we expect, but I'd put 99% likelihood on it right now. On Tuesday, late Tuesday, between probably 10 and 11 a.m. in the morning on April 10th. But you will know by going to the Lawyers Committee website, which I think is LC4FOR911.org. LC4FOR911.org. Just go there in the morning of April 9th, Monday, and if the petition is up on their website and if the article about it is on opednews.com by late morning on Monday, April 9th, then you will know that it will be delivered on late morning the 10th.
Okay. Is there any point for, hello? Is there any point in showing up at the courthouse?
I don't know if that is desired or not. So what I would recommend that you do, I don't know. There was some discussion of having some kind of a press event on the steps or at City Hall. I mean, that's just looking into that. The bottom line is you're not even supposed to know about this yet, okay?
Yeah, but we will know about it on the 9th.
Yes, on the 9th you will know about it. So on the 9th, it's okay for you to officially know about it. And what I would recommend is you contact Les James and see.
Okay.
He will be, because he's taping, he will know what is being planned if there is an event that you should attend surrounding this.
Okay.
Okay.
That's clear. Thank you. All right. So, Barbara, you had a good idea when you were talking earlier with one of our guests about somebody we might have on the call. Who was that?
Well, that was this guy Gordon Shea, who did the Shea memo.
Yeah, but it was the person with the memo, or involved with the memo, right?
Gerald Shea.
I'm sorry, Gerald Shea. I'm sorry, not Gordon. Gerald Shea, it was Sander, mentioned that he's trying to track him down. He's so impressed by the Shea memo. And I just said to Sander that if he ever does actually track him down, ask him to be a guest on this call.
Right, very good. Okay, so any other ideas of who we might have on upcoming calls?
Lynn Bradbury, Allison Weir, looked like she might be willing to next month?
Hi, I'll need to call or email Allison Weir again. She responded and was on her way the next day to Lebanon for a week, and she sounded interested, but she couldn't think about it right that minute. So I'll remind her and get back to you.
Okay.
She must be back by now.
Hopefully.
So this is Wayne.
Oh, Wayne.
Yeah, so how about Claudio Marti from the I Am the Faceless Group campaign?
I'm not sure I know who we're talking about. Can you give us a brief idea?
So Claudio Marti has formed a group called I Am the Face of Truth. What he does is he posts banners on he's got a whole team of people who will help him put banners up on Facebook, change your picture on Facebook to have a banner that says, I am the face of truth and you save your country. And they've got 16,000 or so of these banners that they've made floating around Facebook. And so, for example, if you go find me on Facebook, you'll see that I've got a banner, I'm the face of truth, United States or Connecticut or something like that. And so they've been doing this, and it's a passive marketing campaign. Been doing it since 2014, and he's just they just had their first kind of a seminar, a conference workshop, and he'd be a good person to be on to talk about passive marketing of 9/11 truth or marketing it. So.
Can you invite him?
Yeah, I'll do it.
Okay.
I think that would be a great idea. He's been incredibly successful.
Mm-hmm. Sounds good, Wayne. Thank you.
So I do have a concern based on what Barbara has been talking about. In order for this thing to remain silent, should you all postpone posting the audio of this, because we don't know who will listen to it and who will spread the word. But I think the group here is probably trustworthy enough, but I don't know if the others might not hear the request to keep it silent so strongly. So, Barb, what do you think about not posting until the 9th?
You mean not distributing the audio of this call until we know it's happening on the 9th? Is that correct?
That's right.
I have a problem with that. I'd like to state that real quickly here. Anything that's stated on this call is, first of all, considered public for our listeners, and second of all, made available as soon as possible to people that weren't able to come to the teleconference. So I think we kind of need to leave it there, and I think Barbara's proviso that it not be spread is something that everybody who's got access to the call has to recognize as being a valid fence around it, okay? I think that's all we can do, really. I don't think we want to start keeping our calls secret, okay?
Yeah, I agree. I agree, Wayne. I don't think it's necessary. The caveat was made clear. There are many people who do know, but the important thing is not to do anything to disturb the exclusive arrangement with opednews.com, because they do have a huge reach. And that's what we want people to do, is to wait until the night, check opednews.com, check the Lawyers Committee website, lcfor911.org, on the mid to late morning of the night. And if you see the petition on the Lawyers Committee website and the article about it on Op-Ed News that morning, Monday the 9th, then you know you're free to, and please, blast it out. Blast both of those links and why they matter out to your email list, and ask everyone to, in turn, take it and forward it to all of their lists.
Yeah, anybody that jumps the gun on this may have it in their face anyway, as often as it's been postponed, so just saying.
Well, exactly. You can't know that it's, please, you're not going to know for sure with all the postponements, for good reasons, but it's been postponed at least 6 times. And because Mick Harrison has to drive all the way to New York City, and he lives in Indiana, I believe. So there are all kinds of inputs, but I really do feel that this time it's going to happen. The weather's gotten better. It was horrible storms in New York City before. There were all kinds of reasons. But it might not happen on the 10th. But you'll know if it's going to happen on the 10th if you see it on those two websites on the 9th.
Okay. So any other suggestions for future teleconference guests that we could think about? Anybody in the news or on the forefront of the truth movement that anybody can think of?
Well, I have an announcement to make. I have recommended that we have Greg Ford. He's an amazing whistleblower and a great patriot. He just had a terrible stroke. We don't know if he'll be able to even talk. So that's no longer possible. I appreciate all of your prayers going to him. He was the whistleblower, the only medic at Abergray Prison, blew the whistle, filed the official Geneva Convention's complaint about the torture, and for having followed the law, the only one to do so at Abu Ghraib prison, he was kidnapped, tortured, and renditioned by his own military superiors. So he's a wonderful person. I will send again the link to everybody of my interview with him that is on YouTube. It's the audio with his photograph. It's only 27 minutes. I highly recommend you listen to it. And I have, thank God, recently I was at Danny Sheehan, the attorney, and Danny Sheehan's wife, Sarah Milton, and Greg Ford and myself were together at Sea Ranch here on the coast of California recently for 2 days and nights. And thank God I was able to interview Greg before his stroke happened for about a half an hour, just on his phenomenal experience that's directly related to 9/11. So I will be, I have the audio tape. It's on a small cassette. I need to get it into an MP3 file, I guess it is, and get it to the list. But I will do that with a transcript in the not too distant future.
Okay, then I guess we don't have any other suggestions. So remember, if you do come up with something between now and the next teleconference, get to Cheryl by the week before the teleconference. That's the Wednesday before the teleconference. Okay.
So Ken, yep. I'll say that I have. This is Wayne again. I do have another Pentagon-related presentation I would be willing to do, but I don't think I'm able to schedule that until. May, but I'm not sure what. I'm just letting you know it's there if you want something to talk about. I'd be going through the security two security cameras in reviewing what you can see in them, and it's really interesting. Over.
Okay. Well, you, I guess you know, whenever you're ready, you just you know, let Cheryl know, and we'll schedule it in. Okay.
Okay.
And any other suggestions? Now, I'm hearing none. I guess we're done for tonight. We'll have to run with what we got for next time and hope something else comes up in between now and then. Again, send it to Cheryl if you have something between now and the week before the teleconference. So.
Oh, it's Barb. It's Barb. Of course. We want to have Mick Harrison on to talk about the Lawyers Committee petition.
Well, that's if. Yeah, absolutely. If it happens, then sure, we agree that that should be a major topic of the next call. Since that's a contingency, we can't really declare it right now. But yeah, definitely ask him if he will. If
all
it
right,
happens.
I will. Yeah, I'll ask him. I'll ask him and Dave Marshwinkle and Julio Gomez and Bob McElvain, because they're the four who will be the current plan delivering it, and some permutation or combination. I'll ask to be on the call.
The more the merrier.
The date is April 25th. Okay.
Yeah, 25th is the next teleconference. So, except for this one issue that we're talking about here, we should try to get to the 17th, by the 17th, to Cheryl if you have something, okay? All right, ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your cooperation tonight, and we'll see you on the 25th of April for the next one.
Okay.
Have a good night.
Bye, everyone.
Night. Hi, everybody.
Good night.